Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Robin Hemley. He's director of the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa in the Department of English. He has published 7 books, both fiction and nonfiction. His most recent is entitled Invented Eden, The Elusive Disputed History of the Tacidae. That book came out in 2003. He also co-edited the anthology Extreme Fiction, Fabulists and Formalists with Michael Martone. He's the author of a memoir, Nola, a memoir of faith, art, and madness. He's also the author of the novel The Last Studebaker and story collections The Big Ear and All You Can Eat, and has received a number of awards for his fiction, including the Nelson Algren Award from the Chicago Tribune. He's here visiting the campus and will be giving a reading. He'll be making an appearance at the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. That's on the second floor this afternoon at 4:30. And he's also here to meet with student writers. One of the things, we like writers on this show, and when we have the opportunity, people pass through here, we'd like to have them come on the program and talk a little bit about writing, and we're glad that he is here with us as well. And of course, people who are listening, if there are questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you will forgive me, everyone will forgive me for once again raising the, as a way of starting out, raising the issue of, now you know what I'm going for, don't you? Of James Fry and In a Million Little Pieces. Mm-hmm. The people who have heard already more than they ever want to hear about this, they're the ones who have to forgive me. Maybe there are some people who still don't know this story. But basically what we had here is a man who wrote this book, A Million Little Pieces, mm-hmm. which was promoted as a memoir mm-hmm. about his experiences in his life and his triumphing over his own personal demons and so forth. And it's a book that was quite popular and got a lot of attention, in large part because Oprah Winfrey gave it her thumbs up. And then just recently, it was determined that most of the stuff that was in the book, particularly a lot of the really dramatic stuff, was fabricated.
Right.
He just made it up. And eventually he admitted that, in fact, that he did, and that he said something to the effect of, well, you know, it made a better story that way. And one of the things that that I know I read in some of the articles about it was that, in fact, when he started out, when he wrote this book, initially he wrote it as a novel and was trying to get it published as a novel, and nobody was interested. And I guess one of the publishers said something like, well, do you think maybe we could make this a memoir? And you may have to make some adjustments. Obviously, the publisher didn't want to publish it as a memoir if it wasn't true. But he wanted to get the book published, and it was. And then now he's had to publicly, in a pretty embarrassing sort of way, say, well, yes, in fact, most of this stuff I made up. So after having said all that, I guess the thing that I'm interested in maybe trying to talk about with you, particularly since you're someone who has written both fiction and nonfiction, mm-hmm. is this ground between the two, between fiction and something that might be called autobiography or memoir or whatever, that we assume to be the truth, mm-hmm. mostly. Is that really such a fuzzy ground in there, in between those two things?
Well, I think it depends. This is a problem that's plagued memoirists for centuries, actually. I've been doing a little research in this, and there was in the 17th century, a guy known as George Psalmnazar, who went through Europe claiming that he was a native of the island of Formosa. And since hardly anyone had been to Formosa, he was able to write this memoir saying he had, that he was a cannibal and all this other stuff, and wrote a very successful memoir. And then finally was uncovered as a hoaxer. And this has happened many, many times. I mean, James Fry is not the first time. I mean, there was The Education of Little Tree, which was supposedly about a Native American orphan. Big bestseller, became a movie. It was written by a white supremacist KKK member. There was also a fake Holocaust memoir that came out several years ago in Germany called Fragments, and it turned out to be completely invented. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is problematic, but it's problematic for, it's an ethical question. It's a problem that I think has something to do with the genre, but has something to do with just the human tendency sometimes of people to lie and to be self-aggrandizing and to try to make money. Yeah. And I think part of the problem, though, I think James Frey has been demonized a little too much. I think part of the problem comes, as you say, with the publisher. The book had been gone around, made the rounds, I think been rejected by 17 publishers or so as a novel. And then Nan Talese at Doubleday said, well, you know, it makes a better memoir. And he was a first-time author out of the gate. And I'm sure he was tempted by this. And I'm not saying he wasn't, culpable in some way, but I think some of the culpability should lie with the publisher, with marketing. And I've been sort of interested in this whole idea that a bad novel makes a good memoir. It, to me, that says something not so good about what we expect sometimes from memoirs, where we expect the memoir to be a kind of content delivery system, where we want this sort of rehabilitated James Frey delivered whole to us, hugging Oprah, and Oprah saying, oh, you survived, we're so happy, when instead we should also be looking at the quality of the book, not simply the content, that this is a story of redemption and so on. Mm. And so to me, it says something troubling about, what we as a reading public or Oprah or whoever wants from a memoir as opposed to a novel.
Well, I think, to me, one thing that's an interesting question is, why is it that within the past, now I don't know how many years it's been, maybe even the past decade, and I don't know, that the confessional memoir has become so popular? There are so many of them. What does it say about us, generically speaking, mm-hmm. that it seems that we want to read books like that?
Well, it's a good question. I don't have any easy answers for it. I've been thinking about it a lot myself, and I've been thinking about this whole movement in our culture also towards reality TV as well, and that's, as we know, reality TV is pretty unreal. And I also tend to believe that that as soon as one puts down something on the paper, it is fictionalized to some degree, in that you're creating, you're not telling some things, there are sort of sins of omission and so on. But I don't know what makes us crave right now these kinds of tell-all memoirs from ordinary people. This sort of memoir boom started, by my reckoning anyway, in the 1980s with Tobias Wolff's This Boy's Life, which, curiously enough, he also started as a novel and then decided it was more of a memoir. And I'm sure, you could go through... his book is nothing... There's nothing sensational about it. It's about growing up in a little town, Concrete, Washington, in the 1950s. It's a beautifully written book. And it has the kind of narrative arc of a novel. I'm sure there's some fabricated bits of dialogue and so on. But one would never I think people always want a good story. People always want a story well told. But there's always been some kind of allure to the words based on a true story. Or a true story. The movie Fargo, for instance, the opening credits, it says, based on a true story. Well, the Coen brothers just put that in for a lark. It wasn't a true story at all. Mm-hmm. They just, I think, did it as a kind of joke on our culture, saying, isn't it funny that we pay attention when we think this really happened?
Yeah. when talking about Fry with a colleague, she said something to the effect of, well, you know, a memoir is not an autobiography. And I started thinking about that, and I guess my expectation is that there's not that much difference. I can accept the idea with a memoir that a person is saying to you, this is the way I remember it. Mm-hmm. This is my take on what happened to me. And I guess I understand the fact that people's memories are imperfect. People remember stuff that actually didn't really happen. So that indeed is that person's, it's their take, their spin on what happened. But I do expect that it actually happened. So there's a difference between doing, well, this is my take on something, and completely making something up. I mean, is that really the difference between those two, between autobiography and memoir, is that really such an unclear sort of a thing?
Well, I mean, this is a debate that's really been going on among writers for a long time, too. I mean, people feel very differently about it. I don't think there's any clear consensus. Some people who come from a more traditional journalistic background will say, you know, if I can't verify it, I'm not putting it in. Mm-hmm. And other people are sort of more self-forgiving in that way. I'll tell you, in my case, I've written a memoir about my older sister who was schizophrenic. And I wrote, followed that with a book that's investigative journalism. And I know, to me, one of the distinctions I made as a writer was that I would never even consider something of writing something that has a kind of historic that's supposed to be part of the historical record, my Tassadai book, and fabricating anything or changing characters. I mean, there were times I wished I could have. There was one woman who I met in the Philippines named Dula, and another woman named Duel, and having the names so close together was very confusing writing it. And I would have loved to have combined them into one character. But, of course, I couldn't do that. In a memoir, writing about my own family, I came up upon these questions of fabrication, you know, recreating dialogue, remembered stuff. And, you know, I tried to do it as accurately as possible, but I'll give you a small anecdote about this that to me illustrates some of the problem that a memoirist comes upon. I was writing a scene about that took place in 1970 when I was 12 years old, and we were in Long Beach, New York, and my sister told my mother and myself that we'd been invited to this ashram in Jamaica, Queens, by her guru to spend Christmas with them. So we got on the Long Island Railroad. We didn't have anything better to do. We went to this ashram. As soon as we showed up, it was clear no one expected us, and my sister had neglected to tell us that the invitation she received had been a telepathic one, that in fact no one had done this, you know. Mm-hmm. And so they still greeted us warmly. And so I was going to write this whole scene. I remembered it pretty well. But then I told my mother, you know, about that I wanted to write the scene. And I said, so it was me and you and Nola. And she said, and your brother. And I said, no, he wasn't there. What are you talking about? And she said, no, he was there. Ask him. So I emailed my brother and said, were you there? And he said, yes, I was. And so I had this dilemma. Do I write him into the scene when I didn't remember him? And he has no emotional impact on me in that scene, or do I write the scene as, you know, as I remember it? So, so I decided to write him into the scene, and I think that was a mistake, because now in the book, if I regret any scene in the book, it's that one, because he's sort of a zombie. He just sort of is a piece of furniture in that scene. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I probably could have written it better, but he has no emotional impact on that scene. And I think if I had cut him out, it wouldn't have mattered one way or another to anyone, least of all him. He didn't even want to be in the book.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking about the fact that recently, a few weeks ago, I talked with John Berendt, the man who wrote Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Mm-hmm. about this new book that he has out. It's about Venice, mm-hmm. City of Fallen Angels or Falling Angels, something like that. It's great. It's a nice title. And one of the things that I, in reading about the previous book, he apparently got in some trouble because he rearranged some things in the story. He did some things that he thought would make for better story flow, and he was criticized for it because that, again, that was a book that was presented to be this is what happened.
Right.
And one of the things that's very striking about the new book is that right in the front of the book, there's a paragraph that says, all events here actually took place the way they happened. I didn't change anybody's names. I didn't change anything. He puts that right up front. And it's pretty clear that he did that because he got into so much trouble about the other book. But now that makes me thinking now, is everybody going to have to put some sort of caveat on the front that either says, I didn't make anything up. Bang, there's a seal. Or, well, okay, maybe I sort of made some stuff up. Or is everybody going to have to be upfront that says, the work that you're about to read is true, or it's sort of true, or...
Well, I don't know. I mean, there some people have a tongue-in-cheek approach. There is a memoir, I can't remember the title of it, but the subtitle says, a memoir that's 85% true. And I don't know, what kind of effect all this will have. But I think that we have to expect that when someone's writing about their life and things in the past and things like that, things are going to be just misremembered or rearranged or whatever. And you do it as much for the narrative arc of the book as for anything. You know, I remember I asked Tobias Wolff about this boy's life. Hmm. I said, this was back in the early 90s before I'd begun my memoir. And I said, your book is so finely detailed. You know, you remember these amazing conversations from 40 years back. How do you do that? And he gave me a very writerly, evasive answer, which was, if I want to be absolutely sure of everything, I would either write the world's shortest memoir or the world's longest memoir because it would be so full of equivocation, and you write it sort of it's a marriage between the sort of the requirements of the story and the requirements of I suppose truth telling.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone who's listening. We have a caller in Atlanta, Illinois on our toll free line 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Interesting conversation. I got another twist for what to do to solve this dilemma of the memoir. Of course, this isn't my idea, but I read a novel quite a few years ago. It's by Ed Abbey. It's probably his last novel that he wrote here before he died. And the name of the novel escapes me, which is sinful. But underneath in big letters was, after the title, A True Novel. Now, having read that novel and then read a couple biographies of Ed after he had passed away, there was an awful lot of truth. And as a matter of fact, everything was probably basically true, but the chronology of everything, the way it was put together, probably wasn't exactly right. And, of course, names have been changed and those kind of things. But there's one. I mean, maybe he kind of honestly solved that dilemma back when he put A True Novel on there. I never quite knew what that meant, but now through this conversation, I'm beginning to understand what he was trying to say.
That's an excellent comment. It reminds me of the writer Frederick Exley, who wrote a book called Fan's Notes, and he subtitled it A Fictional Memoir. And he even had a wonderful disclaimer in the beginning of it, saying, although the character was named Frederick Exley and there was a wife in there, he didn't want his ex-wife to think it was really her and so on. It was the disclaimer was worth the price of the book alone. But yeah, I think that some sort of some kind of combination would be great.
We'll carry on. Great conversation.
Okay, thank you. Well, it brings to mind the again going back to James Frey. Sorry, the initial reaction I think of the publisher to when the story broke that a lot of it was fabricated. I think the publisher initially tried to say it doesn't matter, which goes to this very idea that says that there in fiction there can be truth, mm-hmm. and I think everybody would say, well, Yes, sure, of course, no doubt about it. But somehow that doesn't quite excuse what happened here. If that's the way it was going to be, then from the outset, it should have been clear that it was a fictionalized memoir or, you know, something like that. That it started and said, yeah, it's sort of about me, but I made stuff up. And it should have been really clear.
Well, you know, I think also the term nonfiction, the way we use it, we sometimes say fiction is not true and nonfiction is true. And that's really not what nonfiction and fiction always mean. I mean, nonfiction to me, a good friend of mine, David Shields, a wonderful writer, says he sees nonfiction as a kind of excavation of the self, at least the memoir, you know, a kind of where you're reading it not always for a kind of dramatic revelation the way you would in fiction. You know, this happens and then there's a climax and everything falls apart. In memoir, often you're looking at a kind of mind at work. You're sort of uncovering a personality to see how someone thinks. There's a wonderful writer that I love named W.G. Sebald, who passed away several years ago, but he wrote a series of books that are really genre-defying, really blurred boundary books. One of them is called The Rings of Saturn, and it's a kind of travel log, in a way, of East Anglia in England, complete with photographs and even a photograph of him. And yet it was classified as a novel, but there are photographs in it, and it seems to be very autobiographical, and yet he never sort of answers in the book why. I mean, there's no way to really understand why it's called a novel. And I actually love those sort of genre blurring books. I think we've had a long tradition of loosely veiled memoirs in the past that were called novels. They're often called romana clefs, like Thomas Wolfe's Look Homeward, Angel. He wrote about a lot of people in Asheville, North Carolina. In fact, when that book came out, people in Asheville were so angry at him that he couldn't go back for several years. And then when he went back as a world-famous author, a number of years later, the only people who were angry at him were people—
the ones who were not in the book.
Exactly, yeah.
Also, I should introduce again our guest for anybody who has just maybe tuned in the last 10 or 15 or 20 minutes. Robin Hemley is director of the Nonfiction Writing Program at the University of Iowa in the Department of English. He's published 7 books of both nonfiction and fiction, including Invented Eden, The Elusive Disputed History of the Tacidae, the memoir Nola, A Memoir of Faith, Art, and Madness, and also a novel, The Last Studebaker. And he is here visiting the campus. If you're interested in meeting him and hearing from him, he's going to be at the Author's Corner in the Illini Union Bookstore. That's on the second floor at 4:30 this afternoon. He's here visiting the campus to talk with writers and would-be writers all. And questions are certainly welcome to here on the show. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let us talk with some more of the people who are listening. Urbana next, line number one.
Hello. Oh, hi, how are you?
Yes.
This is actually an interesting subject, the nature of reality and how people, like if you were saying earlier how one of your brothers was at a meeting, you don't even remember him being there, so when you added him and it didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
There's a paper published last year, like in September or October, in Science Magazine about some neurologist in the University of California did some MRI studies, functional MRI studies of pathological liars. They noticed that the better liars they were, whatever that means, the thinner the layer of the gray, what they call the gray, you know, simplified, the gray matter versus the white matter of their brain or the cross-section, the thinner that was, the more, creative they were.
Hmm.
And one of the authors of the paper went a little further and started asking, you know, like the art people in school, and they found out that all these people that had thinner layers of this gray matter were more, quote, creative.
Hmm.
And so all these people that, you know, we talk about, you know, the truth in writing and all this stuff, you wonder sometimes, you know, people are honored for their creativity in this culture, especially, you know, for directors, writers, poets, stage people and stuff like that, you always wonder if there's that fine line between stepping over the acceptable boundary of creativity versus the unacceptable boundary of creativity, which is like the Fry book, supposedly. You know, all of this is a lot. There's so many lies in this, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I also wrote a book called Turning Life into Fiction, a craft book. And in it, I say that, you know, if you were a good liar as a child, you'd probably make a good fiction writer because lies, troubles, and daydreams are part of what make stories. I was a pretty good liar as a kid, you know, but I certainly hope, I know the difference now, you know, when I'm writing something that's supposedly true. I try to stick as close to the facts as I know them. But, as a kid, I was always, writing fake notes to my teacher saying that I could have a rabbit or something that, you know, knowing my mother wouldn't allow me. So, yeah. You know, except I spelled it rabbi instead of rabbit, so it was a kind of dead giveaway.
Well, also, just a quick one, I'll let you go. I know that people want to talk, but there's something in French deconstructionists in language and stuff, and how language is an incomplete way to communicate, which, of course, is somewhat illogical. But language in and of itself is a tool. I've started writing over the last couple of years short stories, and I wrote a couple of novels. I have nothing published, but I noticed that the creativity, when you put it on paper and words, you know, you can create these worlds and or these events that maybe didn't happen or they, you know, your imagination or whatever. But it's interesting to this whole idea of, you know, when people are aghast that someone has lied, like the Fry book. I think it was overpublicized. But all politicians, you know, you look at a politician, they go, "Well, he's lying to me," but oh, that's okay. I'll vote for him anyway because they all lie. It's a very interesting subject, how people perceive things. Like, you're talking about your brother, but I have a sister, and I'll mention something, and I'll go, my sister goes, "No, it wasn't like that. It was like this." And so, okay. So is it the inability to remember it correctly? Like you guys said, that author had all these extremely detailed conversations from 40 years ago. I find that almost impossible.
Right.
It has to be a compilation or something, you know. But I'll let you go. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
It's a reconstruction. It's almost always a reconstruction. In fact, the director who made Tobias Wolff's book in This Boy's Life into a movie went to the hometown of Concrete, Washington, and all these people came out of the woodwork to say, "Oh no, it didn't happen this way; it happened that way." And he just said, "You know, I never let the truth get in the way of a good story." And Tobias Wolff had told a good story. As it happens, his brother Jeffrey Wolff had also written a memoir about their father. Tobias Wolff had the family had split up when they were kids, and Tobias Wolff had gone with the mother, and Jeffrey Wolff had gone with the father, and he wrote a book about the father called The Duke of Deception. And when the director was reading the book, he said, "Well, this is a wonderful book, but I have this sense that the mother in Tobias Wolff's book isn't a very complete portrait." So what he did, and I thought it was very smart, he went and read The Duke of Deception to get a more critical view of the mother from the brother, and was able to get a better portrait. So anytime we write something, even if we think it's the truth, of course, it's an incomplete portrait.
Let us go to another caller. This is someone in Rankin, and it's line 2. Hello.
Hi, guys.
Mm-hmm.
You're cracking me up with your disclaimers on some of those books of the true stories. I was trying to pitch a sci-fi book that I wrote, and I put down that was based on a true story. When I hear you talk about the hucksters that are getting published, my experience with the industry is that there's a lot of con men out there purporting to be agents or, you know, people that can help you get published. Can you talk about your own personal experiences, Robin, on how you got published? Does it require academia? Does it require industry connections? And can you talk about the integrity of the industry right now?
Well, it doesn't require academia. I think, you know, for me, it's been persistence, and it's always a bit of an uphill climb. I mean, the first thing is actually sitting in front of the computer and writing, you know, because a lot of us, I mean, I find that, you know, once you've written something, it is often difficult then to place it. And even established writers these days have quite a lot of difficulty placing their books because the publishing world has been going through all kinds of upheavals in the last 20 years or so. It's become much more like the movie industry in that it's more blockbuster oriented. You're only as good as your last book. You know, there are plenty of great books that are turned down because the sales of an author's previous book aren't blockbuster. And it used to be. See, my father was a publisher back in the 50s and 60s. He died when I was a young boy, but he was a publisher and published a lot of famous writers, Susan Sontag and Isaac Singer and so on. And at that time, there was a lot of loyalty between publisher and writer and editor and writer. And now editors are changing houses all the time. I've had 3 out of my 4 agents have quit the business simply because they're so discouraged by publishing.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's an uphill battle for everyone, and there's no way in which I mean, certainly it's nice if you meet someone at a writer's conference, for instance, who's an editor, and they say, "Well, send me your book." That's an entree, but it's certainly no guarantee that they'll publish it.
Thanks a lot.
Sure. All right, thanks for the call. Others welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I was pleased to hear you trot out the old saw about never let the. I guess the way I always heard it was never let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That's an old joke among journalists. Which moves me though to ask about, given that you are director of the nonfiction writing program,
mm-hmm.
how you go about helping people to take a true story mm-hmm. and tell it in a way that also makes it a good story without mm-hmm. sex. So having elements of drama, make a story compelling, make it so that readers will want to read it,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, stick with it, you know, be faithful to whatever the events or the material that form the basis for the story.
Well, the students in my program often come in with pretty highly formed opinions on the subject of their own, you know. And it's very hard to shake someone's idea of what is acceptable, you know, because these are often ethical questions, you know. I just know some people who have a very low tolerance for any kind of authorial manipulation, if you will, and some people who love it. I mean, I personally love it, and I teach books like in my classes. There's a book by the psychologist Lauren Slater called Lying. And with a title like that, it's a nonfiction book called Lying, but with a title like that, you know you're in some murky territory. The first chapter, and I can tell you the whole first chapter, it's I exaggerate. And then chapter 2. And the next chapter, it goes into her childhood, and it's all about how she had childhood epilepsy. And then she says, but maybe I didn't have epilepsy as a child. Maybe I'm just using this as a metaphor. Well, right there, some people are outraged, you know. And then some people say, well, okay, what's she getting at? And I think it's a wonderful book. But she puts it right out front that she might be manipulating and playing with you and trying to get at a, quote, a larger truth. So we talk about those things. We read things that are fairly journalistic accounts, and we read things that are more playful, like Lying, and really try to get a good sense of the full spectrum of the genre, because it's a huge genre, and people feel very differently about this. But I like to give people sort of I think the more well-read in the genre people are, the more they can sort of tackle this problem on their own.
Yeah. Well, this might also be sort of a hair-splitting question, but I guess I am assuming that at the University of Iowa there's a Department of Journalism.
Yes,
there is. So that you could go and study that kind of nonfiction writing. What is the difference between nonfiction writing in the Department of English and journalism?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that sometimes there is some overlap, just as there's some overlap between people writing fiction in the writer's workshop and people writing nonfiction in ours. I mean, there's always some inevitable blurring. But I've been reading, I think Susan Sontag, she wrote a book called On Photography. And in this book, she talked about how the same discussion really that's going on now in nonfiction was really going on with photography since photography was invented, and this sort of clash between a sort of what she called a moralized ideal of truth-telling via journalism and an aesthetic kind of sense of what's beautiful, and that these things have clashed in photography for, you know, is something, quote, authentic, or is it something that is being photographed not as a record but as something to, you know, move our senses? And I think that translates really well into the whole dilemma that we're having right now about nonfiction. But I think in journalism, it tips more to the sort of the ideal of truth telling and accuracy in a kind of check your facts way. I mean, and I experienced that, as I said, very much in my book on the Tassadai. Mm-hmm. It was a book where I really allowed myself very little in terms of invention, except in the way that things are ordered. But of course, we know that this whole scandal about what's true and what's not true is as apropos in the field of journalism as it is in nonfiction. There are so many sort of journalists who've been uncovered as, quote, liars in the recent past.
And I want to make sure that I mention, by the way, that Robin talked about that book, Invented Eden, with Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine back in May of 2003, and that interview is on our web archive. So you'd like, if you have the computer and you have the hookup and you'd like to hear him talk about that, you can go back to the web archive, go into the Afternoon Magazine and put his name into the browser, and then you can find that show. That, I think, is also really a fascinating story. If people don't recall, briefly back in 1971, there was this big story, and it got a lot of attention in the popular media, about a supposedly tribe of people that was discovered in the Philippines that was living, had been cut off from the rest of society, had been living essentially in the same way since the Stone Age. And it got lots and lots of attention in the media. And then people started to ask questions about it. And it seems that, well, it's complicated. Because it seems that they were not a Stone Age people that had been living cut off from civilization for 1,000 years. But exactly who they were, that is a much more complicated question.
Yeah, I mean, what was really interesting about that, I think it fits in with our discussion today, is that in fact one of the things I found out was that the people who said the Tassadai were a hoax were, and some of them were journalists, were in fact themselves hoax makers. And there was one ABC journalist, in fact, who was pretty much just, I would say, lying about what she found to make a good story, to make a sensationalized story for the ABC News magazine 2020. And it was a little disheartening for me, because I always think, well, journalists should tell the truth, you know? But you find that sometimes people are, you know, careerist and have selfish motives and know that if they tell this story rather than the truth, they'll get a wider viewer or wider audience. And so it was a really interesting lesson for me in perception and how different people perceived this group. I mean, some people really romanticized them and saw them as our, you know, Stone Age ancestors, and other people saw them as this flat out hoax. And of course, the truth, at least as I see it, lies in between.
Yeah. That's very interesting. So people can look at that. They can go back and hear the interview. We are getting close to the end of our time. I want to get one more caller here. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I think your subject matter is very interesting, and I've been a writer myself, and everything can be true, but it isn't assigned to the person about whom you're writing. And one of the concerns I have, and I've been discussing it recently on the new radio station, on a show called The 11th Indian, about Native Americans. Several years ago, a person wrote, I think it was one of the Scholastic books, about, and they were written by adults, non-Indians, and they were disguised, probably openly, as diaries of the actual children that are writing it's like a diary of a child. This particular story was a diary of somebody, a little Indian girl, and the book was called My Heart is on the Ground. And in it, even though it was treated as a diary, it was full of mistaken ideas about what Native people actually did, about the effect of boarding schools on Native children. And the essence was that it was a good thing, which contradicts the actual history of things. And this kind of leads into this whole idea of how authors, non-Native authors, portray Natives in children's literature. So even though it's not necessarily the kind of stuff you're talking about, they add up to being falsehoods, mm-hmm. and the falsehoods are perpetuated throughout the years.
Well, that's
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's a really good point, and that brings up what I had mentioned, that other book, The Education of Little Tree, which was also about...
That guy is a speechwriter for George Wallace.
Yeah. And he was a member of the KKK, and he also romanticized the orphanage experience of Native Americans. So, yeah, it can be really problematic, just like a fake Holocaust memoir could, in the hands of someone unscrupulous, be used as evidence that the Holocaust didn't happen. You know, there are all kinds of ethical questions that are raised when people invent. If I may add one more, there was a book called Double Flowering that came out that was about from the point of view of a Hiroshima survivor, and it got all kinds of acclaim. And it turned out the guy he wrote these poems in about Hiroshima, and it turns out he's a guy living in Indiana who has no connection at all. So it's interesting.
The kind of stuff I'm talking about is really apropos to our particular community because of our division over representation of Native people. And the whole idea that Native people can't write their own story. And when you talk about Anne Frank, I think of there are a lot of Anne Frank's Native children in the world who did not write. There was no written language, who suffered very similar devastating Holocaust kind of tragedies, and they can never be revived. They can never be uncovered in somebody's attic.
Yeah.
So I find this very, very interesting, and the fact that truth can be so elusive.
Yeah,
I mean,
true.
You may feel the way you feel, but when you try to attribute how people might feel in situations, especially regarding Native people, is a tragedy. And I think it's what happened in this particular community. And people are relatively thoughtless, and mm-hmm. they don't understand how this misrepresentation of the original inhabitants of this country can be so hurtful to people, to children, and to incidents. So when I hear what you're talking about, it resonates very deeply with me about how my people have been misrepresented, and on a daily basis I see the result. And the people who do it are not evil people. You know, they're nice people, they're kind, they give your shirt off your back, but they won't give up some misconception about how Native people are. And I think it's an ironic, well, maybe it's too strong of a word, but it's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I think that's an excellent point.
We are almost at the point where we have to finish. One thing I think you'd like to just mention real quick, people who practice various crafts, you know, they find it helpful to get together with other people who do the same thing. And certainly it's true of writers as true of people who do other stuff. You and our friend Philip Graham have been involved in putting together something that gives writers a chance to get together and talk about their work.
Yeah, we've put together a group called authorsatlarge.com, and it's sort of a traveling literary salon going to sort of off the beaten path destinations like Hong Kong and the Philippines and Croatia, places that people don't usually go for literary trips. But we started this group to bring people together who like to travel and who want a kind of literary experience. Not necessarily; they don't even have to be writers. Mm. I think going well so far. It's called authorsatlarge.com.
All right, so you can go there, and if you want to check it out, do that. It's authorsatlarge.com on the web. Our guest Robin Hemley will be at the Alina Union Bookstore at the Authors Corner this afternoon at 4:30. That's on the second floor. So you'd like to meet him. And if you'd like to sample some of his work, you can do that. And also, if you'd like to hear, as I mentioned, the interview that he did with Celeste Quinn about his book, Invented Eden, it's on our web archive, so you can check it out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate for having me.
Robin Hemley is director of the Nonfiction Writing Program at the University of Iowa in their Department of English.